I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Welcome to another edition of On the Continent, your one-stop place for all things to do with European football. I'm Dotton Adebayo.
I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm Miguel Delaney.
Signing him was easy, relatively, but what about managing Messi alongside Neymar and Mbappe? Pochettino's man management is put to the test by his three musketeers. Also, a greasy return to Atleti for Antoine Griezmann. Is he finding out the hard way that you should never return to your previous lover, unless your name is Cristiano? And how has Balotelli proved to be such a Turkish delight? So we're talking Super Mario and the taste of European promise. Andy, should we start out with PSG beating Lyon at 2-1? Convincingly? Not sure. That's for you to decide. But nevertheless, the issue here is of Neymar, Mbappe and Messi together on the pitch. Did it work?
It's a work in progress. It was clearly going to be a work in progress. And the whole fantasy football element of it has been a little bit underplayed, I think, from the beginning. I guess because of the whole star quality of Messi going to Paris Saint-Germain. There was, for a long time, very little discussion of the fit, how it would work. And the fact that Paris Saint-Germain have been here before in the recent past, the fact that they've been top-heavy, that they've struggled to find balance since the signing, really, of Neymar. And, you know, they've looked like a team of disparate parts in an occasion. That's something that Thomas Tuchel did a little bit to rectify before he went off to Chelsea. But it's something that's very hard, especially for a coach that's as sort of team focused and demanding as Mauricio Pochettino. And as we've said on here before, that's something that he can't do with Messi, Neymar and Mbappe, who demand to be played. Now, we heard Lars having a little snigger about how they didn't exactly hit the ground running in the Champions League at Club Brugge last week. Now, it looked after that, when we were speaking to you guys last week, that Mbappe wouldn't play this game against Lyon because he hurt his foot not once, but twice. I just wonder if it's a sort of signal going forward that they're just going to play these three as much as possible, if there's going to be very little rest and rotation. Because Mbappe played this game against Lyon as if he was injured for most of it. Then he obviously provided the moment of real quality that PSG needed in injury time with a brilliant cross for Icardi, which led to a fairly undeserved winner. Of course, Neymar had beyond manufactured a penalty equaliser. He committed the foul, grabbed Malagusto,
it's a wrestling match,
around the neck, and then pulled himself over at the same time.
It was well done.
It was remarkable. But the thing is, all this, the brilliance of Mbappe, the craft, if you want to call it that, of Neymar, was overshadowed by the look that Leo Messi gave Mauricio Pochettino on the way off. And so much was made of that. This shows how difficult it's going to be for Pochettino, because Pochettino saw him get a little bang on the knee, took him off. You see, what responsible manager is going to leave him on at that point? If he's the coach that leaves him on and then he gets properly injured, he's in massive trouble. He takes him off. He gets the glare from Messi, and Messi knows exactly how it's going to look with 36 cameras in the stadium and God knows how many photographers. Yeah. And then it turns out that Pochettino explains himself quite calmly afterwards, as is his way. And then in this midweek game against Metz, Messi doesn't play because he's carrying an injury. But where's the apology, Miguel, to Pochettino?
I know. Zooming out for a second, I must say some of it's actually quite uplifting. I know they've won 6 out of 6, but given the kind of the grander objectives here, it is quite uplifting that for all their money, given all the huge questions about this whole political project, and how depressing the Messi signing was for all sorts of reasons, right down to a player that pure going down to kind of the fact he had so few choices if he wanted to compete at the top level, all of that. And yet, for all of that, it still doesn't feel like there's actually any sort of football intelligence at the club. Well, I mean, Mauricio Pochettino was a fountain of football intelligence, but that's kind of the issue. Once again, it feels like the whole thing is just so ill-fitting and put together without thought. So you've got this kind of complete clash between some of the biggest stars in the history of the game. In fact, given the kind of the evolution of football over the past 15 years, you might even say the biggest of what they are as entity. Okay, Neymar hasn't done what Pele has done, but kind of as a commercial entity, he's so huge, which puts him on another plane in terms of personality. Yeah. And they've matched that with the ultimate project manager, who, as we've discussed before, is probably best suited to basically working with malleable young players who will run through brick walls with them and press in the way that we've seen the best Pochettino. I mean, like, when you think of the best Pochettino teams, for me, well, I suppose for everyone, it was that Spurs team from 2016 to 18. I remember, okay, it's only against Watford. Remember after that game, the Watford manager, Kike Sanchez-Flores, going on, they only lost 1-0, but he said it could have been 5 or 6. So we played animals today. I've never had a beating like that. Just for the way, they just didn't let Watford out. And that's the best. When I played in Real Madrid, when I played Juventus away, these are the best Pochettino performances. And it's basically just impossible to imagine that at this Paris Saint-Germain. It's just...
It is. And do you know what? We'll go back to Messi in a minute. But the Pochettino thing's really interesting. When you describe how it works best for him and with which players he connects best with, when he was out of work for a longer time than people remember, actually, he was out of work for more than a year after leaving Spurs. The job that kept coming up but never seemed financially feasible, it was Dortmund.
I
think that is a move that would really work for him, and maybe post PSG because they're
younger players.
And their culture of younger players, so that will go beyond the current generation. And like, is Pochettino in a, because there will be an after PSG at some point, and probably not in that distant future. Is this a tricky situation that Pochettino is in, because he's not got the same sort of honours list as, say, Jose Mourinho, but financially he's out of the reach of the kind of clubs that connect with him.
And most of those clubs now, very few of them, or sorry, there's almost a split between them, which is kind of defining this season's Champions League, between the ideology clubs and the kind of the star vehicles. And the star vehicle, I suppose, is Real Madrid, Paris Saint-Germain, Manchester United. Funnily enough, all the clubs he's most linked with beyond Dortmund. But to bring it back to the Messi thing, I think what's, and I kind of, what kind of links these two together. I mean, much play was made when Pochettino met Ferguson in 2016. And, you know, there's a, you know, good relationship there, all the rest of it. If you talk to any young manager who's spoken to Ferguson, or anyone of the, Ferguson's message to any manager is, make sure you've got complete control. If you don't, get out of there.
Mm.
And like, and this is the opposite of the situation he has. As I mean, it's amazing, like, a manager should be, and work so well with complete control as Pochettino, to be in a situation, as you say, where if he leaves Messi's on, he's in trouble. If he takes him off, he's in trouble. It's just, it's almost Kafkaesque.
Isn't it very similar, though? The issue, I mean, you mentioned earlier, and it is fascinating to think that Mauricio Pochettino has, or is ruled out of the clubs that best suit him. But isn't it the same as Messi himself, leaving Barcelona?
Yeah, I think so.
Ruled out of all the clubs that could really benefit from his talents. There's only two or three places he can go to, and he's got to fit in there amongst everything else. And when Messi comes knocking on your door saying, look, here I am, I'm available to play and I'm free, you've got to take him. You've got to take him. And the same thing for Pochettino. When PSG, after a year on the dole, come knocking and say, look, we've got a vacancy, you've got to take it. Even it's PSG at the end of the day, even though you know you haven't got full control.
Yeah. Well, the last thing the Paris Saint-Germain needed, though, really is, okay, what they really want here was kind of profile. That's kind of almost the core of this signing, and we can see
that's it. That's 100%.
Yeah. But in terms of pure football, the last thing they needed was actually another brilliant attacker who at this point of his career won't really move that much except when it's to kind of showcase his quality. There are other teams who could have done that, even high-pressing teams, but not this Paris Saint-Germain team. And then for all the profile they get and all the social media benefit, that starts to pale if, as we saw with Juventus and Ronaldo, if you become a little bit of a joke. And in, like, there is the slight danger of this happening in Europe for Paris Saint-Germain, especially if it doesn't click in the way we've seen so far.
Well, I think maybe joke's a bit strong, but I think dead weight, I think financially, and something that hamstrings the building of a true project. Yeah. And that is the case. I mean, almost, I don't need Mbappe to go. Of those three, the one that you would want to build around is Mbappe. But in terms of releasing extra funds to actually build a proper team, because, God, I can't think of anything that looks harder work than playing central midfield for Paris Saint-Germain at the moment.
Yeah.
Because you've got two fullbacks in Hakimi and Nuno Mendes who just want to go. They don't want to defend. And in Ligue 1, they're not going to be required to defend a lot of the time. But when you get to the back end of the Champions League, slightly different story. Maybe you have to play with three at the back, and definitely not with Sergio Ramos, because goodness knows how many games he's going to play this season because he's not fit. But, and then you've got a front three who don't defend. So if you're Ander Herrera, who's looked great so far this season, or Garner Gay, that is a lot of hard work.
Well, I mean, the one way this Paris Saint-Germain might work as a team, basically, if they signed Kante and put him in front of Verratti. Kante to win everything, Verratti to control it. Then they can go, because Kante doesn't work. But I mean, it does. I mean,
A year playing for PSG would wear him out.
Even Kante.
Kante, really?
Even Kante.
He's got an engine in him.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I do think Pochettino is a better manager than Zidane. All right, and people might be surprised at that because of the difference in trophy count. But I suppose it's what you do with your resources and the potential of your football. But if you give Pochettino the right project, then go to really high levels. But I think Zidane would probably be better suited to what this is, which is kind of the facilitation.
Star whispering.
Yeah.
It's such a fascinating subject, because sometimes I'm wondering, are we talking business here or are we talking football?
The line's properly blurred.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at Pochettino and you think of the options that he has, you can compare that to the options that Mbappe has, because at one point he was there as the main man, or him or Neymar. Yeah. It was one of the other. Now he's one of three possible main men for the club who the club could build the next few years around. But the question is he? Where is he?
Well, that's the interesting thing. PSG have not given up on him, despite the fact he's made it clear he wants to go, despite the fact he's made it clear he doesn't want to sign again, despite the fact he's made it very clear where he wants to go. The reason that Real Madrid were in for paying all that money for a player who just had a year of contract left, and they were prepared to go up to 180 million euros. Bonkers. 180 million yeah. euros. Let's get our heads around that. Is because they think, or they thought,
he's
certainly.
He's the future.
He
isn't
is.
He?
But they thought if he gets to play with Neymar and Messi for the week, for the year, does he change his mind? Because they've got a year to chip away at him and change his mind. And that has a huge consequence, not just for their future. You could argue for the future of European football, you know, and the balance of power and certainly the balance of, yeah. Of superstars. But like I said, with this little contribution, this little huge contribution that Mbappe makes at the end of this game versus Lyon, it's just a little reminder of, actually, I'm the one. I'm the one that you need. But you look at the start, going back to what we were saying in that game against Club Brugge, again, Mbappe creates the goal for Herrera in that. But really, so far, and it is very early days, he's having to work off scraps because whenever Neymar gets the ball, he wants to give it to his mate.
But, it's true.
Don't you think as well, this is why, even though it's only a group stage game and both will go through, so it probably won't matter that much in the grand scheme of things, but Paris Saint-Germain City is so fascinating next week because there's a slight pressure building up in Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah.
And it's also the contrast. I mean, they're both similar political projects, but it's always felt like City or the Abu Dhabi owners just have more of a kind of an ideology about it. Hence, they've got Guardiola and it's very much a systems team.
Well, they're prepared. There's a whole football structure at City that there's not to the same extent at PSG.
Yeah.
And the owners are happy to let them get on with it.
But what's also, which is something that's kind of, I suppose, danced around in this, is maybe how difficult Messi is to manage. I mean, would the modern... I know there was a possibility it was going to happen in the last two windows, but would the modern Guardiola work with the modern Messi as well? I mean, because when they're together in between 2009, 2011 or 2012, Messi was perfect for him because he was a sonic blur of energy. So it just fit into the high pressing and obviously Messi's at that point...
Are you saying would he do all the things that frustrated Guardiola about Aguero?
Yeah, I do wonder that. Yeah. And then also, how resistant would Messi have been to it? Because it's something you've only ever heard hinted at. And I've never quite fully bought into the kind of the little dictator stuff. But evidently, I mean, Messi, he's demanding in his own way.
I think you have a very, very solid point. And who's going to win out is the question. Is it Pochettino, the manager, that's going to stamp his authority, particularly when you say this... clash is essentially Man City PSG is a clash between Pochettino and Guardiola, isn't it? Essentially is when the teams are pretty much matched up player for player, etc. So it remains to be seen whether Pochettino, it's sounding to me as if Pochettino doesn't have as much room to stamp his authority as Guardiola.
Oh yeah, we basically
does that make sense?
All complete. But City kind of
absolutely
the whole structure has been built specifically for basically a manager like Guardiola. But it's a fit. I mean,
they had to set the table to get him to come.
Yeah, basically.
And they spent years on doing that.
Manchester
City. Whereas with Pochettino, it was you're available, you're of a reasonable profile, and there's a subtext of you knowing the club, but you don't know the club as it is now, even though you have historical connection with the club. And you know, he's learning on the job, and the job has changed since he got there.
And I mean, there is a feeling within football as well, basically, that Pochettino, if he wants to succeed, ultimately he has to change, which could be quite a jarring process for him, given how defined his ideas are, how well his ideas work at the right club, but it's at this club. I mean, maybe he will adapt.
I'm not a betting man, but I'm putting a fiver on City. C'est peut-être la dernière pour Di Maria, qui essaye d'un ballon long de trouver Mbappé et Neymar au deuxième ballon. La passe elle est bonne pour Hakimi. La dernière, la voilà. Barcelona features again in the next topic that we're going to talk about. Antoine Griezmann going back home. You would have thought that he's going back home to his natural home in Spain, Atleti. They would hang out the bunting for him. It would be glorious. And of course, he'd score a hat trick on his return as Cristiano Ronaldo would. But it didn't quite go like that, did it?
Well, there's a few things there, I suppose. Primarily, unlike Cristiano Ronaldo, where he's going back still as Cristiano, the, you know, one of the greatest players of all time, and to a club where he's absolutely worshipped, Griezmann has had a very difficult time at Barcelona that feels like it's manifestly affected his reputation. He goes back where it doesn't feel like he's as effective a player. Now, again, that might be because of the system he's playing at Barcelona. And also, I suppose that Atletico are the champions. They've moved on. They're just not, there's not the same yearning for such a player. Okay, it made a certain logical sense for, given what Atletico have been as a club and the amount of change over there, given his relationship with Simeone. But it almost felt like one of the, given the, it felt like a transfer that happened more because of the current state of Spanish football, rather than any sort of football idea.
It's an opportunity, it's not a plan.
Yeah,
I don't think there's any doubt about that. Because if they'd have, obviously there was the negotiation for him earlier in the summer. If they really think he's coming, they don't sign Cunha. They don't sign Matias Cunha before. Because now they've got this striker. And Cunha, I think is very talented in the right team. I don't think he's a great fit for Atletico. I can see how he would benefit from Simeone cracking the whip for him. I mean, it'll either be a great success or an absolute disaster, I think, because of the way that Cunha is, or the way that he's shown himself to be so far at Leipzig and Hertha, where he was meant to be the superstar and his interest kind of waned. But Griezmann coming back, they always knew Barcelona, there was a possibility of them coming crawling back and saying, look, we need to get this deal done. What are you saying? And that's why it got done so favourably on Atletico's terms, because Barcelona needed it to happen. Now, I think it's a great opportunity to take. We've already assessed the money aspect of it and the fact that Atletico are getting an incredibly good deal for a player who's still a fine player, as he proves time and again for France, who I think has done okay in a situation for Barcelona where the table was never set for him, as you say, Miguel. But I think the way it all seemed to go so smoothly, from him bossing it with Benzema for France against Finland, and then just riding into the training ground at Atleti the next day on his white horse, getting a haircut in between training and the presentation ceremony, as if I'm back, people. But of course,
that's how he should have done it.
What he hasn't seemed to absorb, or what seemed to, I guess, shock a lot of people outside of Atletico, is he was admired more than loved at Atletico. And I think
he was always agitating to go as well, wasn't he? That was at Barca.
Well, that's the thing, because I think that's been kind of missed from outside. Mm. The fact that Atletico fans are not just pissed off at the decision, the LeBron James style show he made to say, I'm staying, because we know he's obsessed with the NBA. I can get on board with that.
Okay.
And he did that rather clumsy way of announcing he was staying at Atletico, and then less than a year later was negotiating with Barcelona to go, in the middle of them being in the Champions League last 16 against Juventus, where they were subject to a comeback from Cristiano Ronaldo and went out in pretty awful fashion. So clearly the Atletico fans are upset with him about that. But you go back a little further, and I was talking about this at the weekend. In his last season at Atletico, there's a game where they're winning 1-0 at home against a fairly ordinary opposition. I think it's Espanyol or Valladolid. And they're 1-0 up. Griezmann's running the ball out of defence. He gets to the halfway line, and instead of leading the counter-attack, he stops. He holds it up on the halfway line and just wins a throw. And the crowd are quite agitated. Gosh. They're like, come on, we're going to be killing this game. And Griezmann turns around and does this little Mourinho finger to the lips, shush. That they were very, very unhappy with that, Atletico fans. Gosh, and you can understand why. And because I think we see him as such a symbol of that Atletico side, particularly that reached the second Champions League semi-final in 2016. Let's remember, he wasn't part of the team that won the 2014, much loved 2014 team. So he's after that.
And just to cut across for a second, to illustrate how ferociously emotional Atletico fans feel about this, Courtois, despite his status in that team, he's had his little plaque attacked for joining Real Madrid, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Everyone who's played more than 100 games for Atletico has a little plaque outside the Wanda Metropolitano to try and make it home. And yeah, that's been defaced on a number of occasions, the Courtois one. So clearly, Griezmann has sort of... We associate him of this incredible click with Simeone because he's the star player who gives everything. And for that reason, we see him as the embodiment of Simeone on the pitch. Now, really, the embodiment of Simeone on the pitch in that golden era for Atletico is Gabby. It's not Griezmann, despite the talent.
Well, we've got Diego Costa as well. Well, a different aspect of Simeone, maybe.
Even more evil, I would say. But then you look at it and you think of all these little things that build up. Like, for example, you think of when they lost that final in Milan against Real Madrid, which they really should have won. And Griezmann misses a penalty in normal time in that. And whereas afterwards, Juanfran, who misses in the shootout, is in bits.
Goes up to the fans.
Fernando Torres is absolutely inconsolable. And Griezmann goes, well, penalties get missed. It could happen to anyone. Let's get on with it. Which I think is a very healthy way of dealing with things. Yeah. But it's not the same connection with the fans. And I think there's a connection assumed between Griezmann and Atletico fans that's never really existed.
On a wider sense as well, it's in Griezmann's career in that sense. I mean, he actually almost more than anyone tells a little story of kind of Spanish football and the way it's gone. One being kind of a part of an Atletico team that had to be so defiant against the big two.
Yes.
That was broken. Then the way it actually seems insane now as a transfer, given what is, I mean, of course, we weren't to know a pandemic was around the corner. But that summer of 2019, when a player of Griezmann's age goes to Barcelona for that money, and given what's happened to Spanish football since, obviously COVID influence, but already there were kind of forces in place that were going to there was trouble coming down the tracks economically for Spanish football. I remember speaking to a lot of people around the game even in the 2 years before that. So for that money to be spent on a player that age, and now he goes back, and as he goes back, what it feels like is the kind of the last days of Serie A's glory era, where suddenly kind of Milan, Inter and Juve started to do, like these players started to go around between them purely because it just kind of, it made sense for the clubs and these were the only other clubs who could afford the wages of these players. And there's a little bit of that with Griezmann as well, where again, it's kind of it's a transfer of convenience rather than one that makes kind of any sort of football sense.
Yeah, and that's it. I think you look at his start at Atletico and you look at them not scoring in the Champions League against Porto, not really creating that much. Likewise against Athletic last weekend. This week, he plays the first hour against Getafe. Getafe are in absolutely terrible nick at the moment. It doesn't work for him. They take him off and the team drag it out of the fire because Luis Suarez drags it out of the fire and gets them a win. But the click is so bad at the moment. And you think this is a player who's meant to be going home, but there's been no acknowledgement. They're still trying to get the best out of Joao Felix. The main thing is still to feed Suarez, and it should be, because he doesn't just score goals, he scores important goals all the time. He did that last season, he did that again at Getafe during the week. Can he actually be the centre of it again? Because the team have changed the way they played since in the couple of years since they left it. Because Atletico, as we've talked about time and again on here, are further along in the rebuild than either Real Madrid or Barcelona.
They still feel a very strangely put together team. Even the way the kind of the attacking focus is on someone like Suarez with Griezmann. I mean, while he's still pretty much in the prime of his career, he's kind of like he's on the potential downturn now in terms of age. And it's quite. I mean, I suppose they're not really upstarts anymore. Atletico, given they're twice champions in the last 7 years. But this, I think we've said this on the pod before, but it's one thing I've always felt now, but this kind of, or I felt a lot recently, this kind of era of Spanish football and what La Liga has become, which is, there is really the potential for someone to do what Atletico did in 2014, but playing a style of football that's kind of alien to Spain right now, which is something kind of more more volatile, more German, I suppose.
Just tell us you put a tenner on Sevilla.
I know, fine. Yeah.
I wonder, though, if there isn't a case, an argument to suggest that Atleti isn't doing or isn't grabbing hold of the opportunity that they've got here with the other two main players in Spanish football faltering. This is the time for them, isn't it? I mean, they won the league, and I just wonder whether they lost a little bit of the passion after winning the league, because that would have been the ultimate goal, to win the league and to do one over on Barcelona and Real Madrid. Now that Real Madrid and Barcelona are floundering, it gives Atletico surely an opportunity to raise its game and do
something historic. Well, I think because no Spanish club outside Barca or Madrid has retained the title, I think, since Bilbao in 84.
Yeah. It's a long time ago.
So, I mean, that would genuinely be a historic landmark.
It would, but there's still that Champions League itch to scratch.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, in terms of them building as a team, I mean, they feel further away from that than ever. I mean, you know, you go back to the way they were knocked out by Chelsea. Chelsea, who obviously went on to win the Champions League and deserved it. They were so far behind Chelsea.
Yeah, yeah.
Particularly in that second leg at Stamford Bridge. Tactically, physically, quality-wise, in every way. And we've seen with their poor start to this season's Champions League, they need some new ideas in that context.
But my worry is that this is a bigger football issue. That, all right, he's not Mourinho, but he is kind of Mourinho 3.0. Simeone's approach is a little bit now, it's just not... I mean, the emotion he engenders and the emotional response and emotional intensity of a team will always have a fighting chance. But he's quite far from the cutting edge now, I think.
He is, but there's a lot of what he does that works, and the rest, what he needs and what he had arguably when the first great Atletico team of this decade, you go back to like between 2012 and 14, was there. He had players of the personality to interpret his instructions to their own ends. I think he has that again, a different set of players, generally younger set of players with different ideas and a different way of interpreting that. But I don't think he can do it on his own. And because we have this idea of him as this, you know, alpha hard man, we think that it's his players following him like robots. That has never been the case. And remember, like, he had a checkered coaching career before he arrived at Atletico Madrid. And more than one person advised Enrique Cerezo, the president of Atletico, look, I know he's got this connection with the club, don't take him. He's not a good coach. Loads of people said that to him. Now, he's proved that emphatically wrong, but I don't think the idea that he can do it on his own and it just works to the orders of Simeone is correct. Quiere poner al largo rápidamente buscando el desmarque de Fernando Torres. Viene Antoine Griezmann para romper y marcar. Gol de Antoine Griezmann para el Atlético de Madrid.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
This week, there's been loads going on across Stack. Over on the Luke and Pete Show, I'm telling Luke about why my hairstyle has been bothering children.
And she says, why have you got your hair like that?
Yeah.
Why have you got your hair in a ponytail? We've been told that we're not to talk to men who have ponytails.
Good parents.
But that wasn't the parents. They didn't say that.
Right.
She'd just been told at school or something never to trust a man with a ponytail.
Meanwhile, the book club is back with a cracker on Football Ramble Presents. Kate and Jim were joined by Simon Cooper to talk about his new book, delving into the heart of Barcelona Football Club and what its legends were really like.
Johan Cruyff, in my humble opinion, he's the kind of Freud or Marx or Einstein of football. He invented modern football, but he was also a lunatic. Cruyff was a guy who walks into a room and says, you're doing it all wrong, you should do what I say.
Listen to the Luke and Pete Show and Football Ramble Presents every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's talk now about an old friend who has done the rounds across Europe by now, Super Mario Balotelli. He is in Turkey. Who knew? You knew, Andy. You knew, clearly.
Yeah, of course. He sends me a text every time he moves clubs. But,
is he doing well, though?
He's done all right. He had a difficult start. He's signed for Adana Demirspor, who were promoted in the summer. They've made some really weird and wonderful signings, including Yunus Belanda. They've now got Vincenzo Montella as their coach, which is interesting because, well, you could argue that Mario's seen off a coach already 3 games into the season. But the last couple of games under Montella, Balotelli has really fired. He scored his first goal from the penalty spot as they won the first game of the season against Rizespor last weekend. Berki Bjarnason, another familiar name from Iceland, Aston Villa, Basel, etc., scored in that game as well. And then where it really kicked off is this midweek, where they go to the champions, Beşiktaş, away. Demirspor are 3-0 down. It could have been 4. A goal in between goals 2 and 3 was rather controversially disallowed for what looked like a non-existent foul on the goalkeeper. And then Balotelli comes on a sub. He inspires this comeback, scores a brilliant second goal, sets up the last gasp equaliser from Britta Sombalonga. That's right, Britta Sombalonga, who knocks it in on the line. But there's been a lot of focus, and you've probably seen it on the socials, of Balotelli having a word with Sergen Yalcin, the coach of Beşiktaş, who had said he had no brain when he was a pundit. Yalcin said, well, it was after that, you know, that flick he did for Manchester City where he tried to backheel it in that pre-season game.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, in Los Angeles, I think it was.
Didn't work out.
Yeah, and it didn't work out, but it's a pre-season game, and I don't think it's any particular big deal. But anyway, he looked over towards the touchline, Balotelli, and pointed to his head saying, you think I had no brain? look at that. And Yalcin had a word about it afterwards, and he goes, well, this just shows what kind of guy he is, and you know that's why Beşiktaş would have wanted to sign him, and he was just disappointed because Beşiktaş didn't sign him. And there's been focus on Balotelli for this. I think it's all on Yalcin. He looks an idiot for getting involved with this, especially after Balotelli's comeback, played so well, inspired his team against the best, and at the moment, in terms of what they did in the transfer market, arguably best backed team this summer. You know, they've got in players like Michy Batshuayi, Besiktas, and Alex Teixeira, who came back from China. And it's a great comeback. And, you know, Balotelli always has this flush, doesn't he, when he first arrives at club, where he is absolutely flying, and you have this what if moment of like, you know, he could have been absolutely anything he wanted it to be. The power with which he hits the shot against Besiktas, like the power, the dip, totally does the goalkeeper. It's not far from straight at him, but the goalkeeper's still not saving it because it's just such a clean hit of the ball. And I can't think of many people who can hit the ball as cleanly as Mario Balotelli.
He should have a Peter Lorimer catalogue of kind of these long range strikes. There's only about kind of five or six of them. But I mean, one of the most electric moments I've ever been in was in a stadium was the Euro 2012 semi final, which is basically Balotelli's career moment.
Yeah.
And especially the half
when
volley.
He scored that incredible goal.
But also kind of a poacher's header. Yeah. And you're right. Even at Liverpool, and even on moments at kind of Marseille, there's always been moments where like you just think, okay, oh, there is something, and maybe this is finally it. Mm. And then it kind of just it peters out. I suppose the one club that didn't really peter out maybe was, given what he had three and a bit seasons there, was Nice, where there was...
I don't think he realised what he had there.
Yeah.
And you remember like before he went to Marseille, he came back that last summer expecting to get a move. He didn't get it. He hadn't trained. He let himself really get out of shape. And I think some of the criticisms of him, I think, are built around assumption and prejudice. But on that occasion, he really let himself down.
I think that's one thing that's always been said. Basically, his perception doesn't help him. But then from that, he doesn't help himself either. It's almost kind of like the two almost become kind of, it's a bit of a negative cycle.
But are we agreed that this is like his last chance in European football?
Pop, I mean, or it'd be MLS next or something, or
or Far East.
I could see MLS actually, and doing well there. And the point that you make, Andy, is a really important one, that a lot of the criticism of Balotelli, you've got to be a little bit wary of where it's coming from, or and I'm not saying that it's intentionally racist against him, but there is, you know, because when you were talking about him being unfit, I was thinking of Ron Atkinson. Do you know what I mean? Because that is one of the criticisms that's labelled often with black players who don't, quote-unquote, conform, whatever that means. With Mario Balotelli, you knew from the start the incredible goals that he can score. You know, on that 2012 European Championships, there were two goals that were similar that I thought were incredible. One was by Ibrahimovic, because he did more or less the same thing for Sweden. Mm. He did more or less the same thing. But when you put them together, you suddenly see the athleticism of Balotelli to score in the way that he scored. So people knew and know what he can do, but they also know that he's idiosyncratic.
Mm.
And that idiosyncraticism, for me, comes from the fact that I can understand that he was a fish out of water. I remember you were the first person that ever mentioned Balotelli to me. You were the very first person that mentioned Balotelli to me. I never heard of Balotelli. And you were saying, when we were talking on the BBC, and you were saying that, he's crying out for Mancini to come and, you know, save him and take him to Manchester City or something like that, in any case.
It's funny, though, where you were saying before that it's not all bound up with racist assumptions. I think that you can't talk about the career of Mario Balotelli without talking about racism, because it's something he's had to deal with since he was virtually a child, really, in Italian football. And it was something that he found deeply shocking and confusing, because as someone close to him put it to me years ago, he's the most Italian bloke you can imagine. Like,
except he isn't.
That's it. So when he faced this, in stadiums, he just didn't get it at all. And all of a sudden, because he's a rare black player in Italy, it's like, as a teenager, you have to be on the front line fighting back. And at this point, he's still just an Italian teenager who is hoping to spend all the money he's got on flash trainers and pizza and video games. And all of a sudden, you're in this beyond adult world where not only young footballers are in that world anyway, aren't they? You know, you're expected to conform to certain standards of professionalism and maturity when it's not intrinsic, when you need to be taught those things. On top of that, he's expected to fight back against this tide of prejudice that he simply doesn't understand.
I think you are absolutely right to take it back to him playing in Italy as an Italian. Because the joke is, if you're a black guy growing up somewhere, you know, you are wherever you're growing up. You know, I'm a Cockney, you know. I might try and act as if I'm an African, but I'm a Cockney, essentially, a North London Cockney. And at the end of the day, that's how I define myself to myself. But then beyond that, you're being defined by the wider society as just being another foreign footballer. That must trip you up. Imagine that. He's an Italian, but people probably regard him in the same way as they regard all the other footballers coming from Africa or anywhere else around the world that they're coming from.
But I mean, also to go, I suppose, beyond football and quite deep, I mean, to have your identity questioned like that is quite psychologically jarring and can really have a profound effect on people.
And I think,
especially at such a vulnerable age,
it's kind of why Mancini is such an important figure in his career, I think, because he gave him a pass for a lot of that stuff, and he believed in the best of him, and he's continued to believe in the best of him. I think what's the interesting thing about this current flush of form by Balotelli, and it's not yet a season or a half season, but if he can continue to do something here, I don't think
he can get into the World Cup.
I don't think the door is completely shut for Italy. Because if you think the one thing that this Italian team has lacked is a centre forward. And for that reason, if you go back to the start of when Mancini takes charge and he's happy to try out all sorts of different players, as we've talked about before, he calls up huge squads so he can have a look at loads of different players. He leaves the door open for Balotelli to come back. It's not the right moment and it doesn't happen. But you think Ciro Immobile, who's incredible in Serie A in the domestic game, never completely clicked. And the focus of quite a lot of ire at home, they don't have that line leader. If you get a consistent, and I realise it's an if you get a consistent tune out of Balotelli, I think that
will be one of the great World Cup redemption stories.
Imagine.
Amazing. Imagine. I wouldn't put it beyond Balotelli to have looked at those Euros and thought, I should have been there. They did lack a leader, and he is a natural leader on the pitch. Chiesa, I think, took a lot of his steam. You know, it represented Italy as Balotelli.
But he's always needed that Balotelli, some sort of creative foil. And without wanting to like infantilise him, I think that sort of player with whom there's a technical connection, I think is really important. Because there was a point with Italy when you had this nascent partnership between him and Stephen El-Shaarawy that really seemed as if it could be something. Now, we all know what happened with El-Shaarawy and injuries. Now he's making a bit of a comeback with Roma, and there's been some interesting stuff from him in the first couple of weeks of the season. But I think I can see Balotelli and Chiesa working. As long as Chiesa gets to conduct the orchestra, as he's made very clear that he likes to do. If he was holding a big neon sign saying, I'm the technical leader of this team, he could not make it any more obvious. Sure. And I know Nicky Bandini's talked about, you know, maybe that's one of the minor downsides to Enrico Chiesa, that he needs to be the leader. But I think that could work.
Wait and see. So we have a tweet here from Graham. What are your thoughts on the Europa Conference League? Will we see a competition dominated by big clubs who had poor domestic seasons and missed out on the Champions League? Or will we see a competition where clubs from less reputable nations with a European trophy like the Football League trophy. Your thoughts, Miguel, first of all, on this Champions or Conference, European Conference?
Maybe I'm slightly conditioned here, but having started my journalism career covering Irish clubs in Europe, which would invariably end in July, sometimes August, and very, very, very odd time to make. Like Shamrock Rovers once made it into our Europa League, the group stage, and Dundalk did follow that, to be fair. But it does feel like that the Europa, given we've got the Champions League and Europa League, and we see all these kind of clubs from the kind of top 10 to 12 leagues all the time, it feels like the Europa Conference really should have been a European competition for, say, the federations from 25 to 55, and to actually give them a proper chance at European football.
Did it feel to you that's what it was sold as?
Yeah, that's initially what I thought it was going
to
be.
It felt to me, and then you see the first round of matches, and we all love to see great matches in Europe, but then you see something like Ren versus Tottenham.
Yeah.
Two clubs who are absolutely swimming in money.
That's your Europa League match.
Exactly. At worst, I guess Champions League at a push. And you see that and you're like, really? Is that really who this competition is for? Like Ren, who went out and spent like tens of millions on players this season versus one of the richest clubs in world football?
Yeah. I'm just looking through the groups now. And really, okay, bar maybe a Basel. It's hard not to see a situation where we have, it's basically a Roma Tottenham final, and that's kind of that. And then it's just another Europa League where it shouldn't really be that.
You're forgetting the teams that are going to fall out of the Europa League.
Of course, that's part of it, isn't it? But like, I mean, and really what this should be, of course, I mean, because it could be a way for UEFA to redress the balance in other ways, in that like suddenly, whatever about clubs of the kind of the size of it, like in Ireland, the Northern Ireland, or any of the kind of the really kind of bottom 20 federations, also a chance for like some great European names like Red Star Belgrade or Partizan Belgrade to actually have a chance of European silverware again, and with the potential effect that can have. But it just because of the way it's been in this, and UEFA like this with almost everything at the moment, where it's this kind of, this strange, I mean, I could go on another tangent about this completely with kind of Cheffrin's very superficial response to what actually happened with the Super League in the end. But this just feels like the same sort of thing where it's almost like trying to play both sides, and one side, here's a bit to the small clubs, but really kind of still most of the clout and the power is with the big leagues and big power. And as we can basically see.
And that's because of the television revenue, I'd have thought. The big clubs are the ones that bring in the revenue. So it suggests to me that this competition is about the money rather than the, you know, appeal.
Well, I mean, to be the one thing I would say for UEFA is they're looking, UEFA are caught in two stools here, but I do think it's why there are fair questions growing about Cheffrin. Given he basically sees himself as was put to me by someone who works like in these circles, top level of football, he sees himself as a Robin Hood figure. Where I think anyone looking from the outside how can he see that? Because European football has a huge problem with the amount of money it makes. Still, there's a distortive amount of that goes to the top clubs, and the big issue is really what football needs. We've discussed this on the pod so much. It needs a mass redistribution of resources, and Europa Conference, I suppose, in principle, is what it could be, but again, it's not going to fully be. And you can even see it with the kind of the proposals to the Champions League, where it's been discussed that UEFA might get rid of this these coefficient entries. Basically, these already prize money is allocated along these lines. Where, so say, Real Madrid are going to finish 10th in the Spanish league, they'd still get into the Champions League by virtue of the previous 5 years' performance. So that's likely to come in after 2024. UEFA have talked about getting rid of that, but no one has actually done it yet. This conditions this situation where no matter what's done, no matter what measures are made elsewhere, there's still such a critical mass of money going towards the top end. And again, it just feels like the Europa League is part of the same process where there's a good idea there, but it's just it's too compromised by all the forces around it.
Also, the Conference League needs its own anthem. It's got the Europa League anthem at the moment. I mean, come on.
The Europa League changed that. Do you remember Europa League when I remember this when I was at the final in Dublin between Braga and Porto?
Yes.
And it had a deafening, the one that was written by, it was a friend of Michel Platini or something like that.
It was a bit too jaunty, wasn't
it? Yeah, yeah.
Although the current one only sounds good in Wind and Driving Rain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's true, actually. So the original one was a bit close to Game of Thrones as well.
You lot are going off on a tangent, so I won't introduce my
the Europa League theme.
Yeah. Although I've always wondered whether Robin Hood saw himself as a Robin Hood figure or whether he saw himself as a thieving git, which is what he was. It's that time, gentlemen, when I ask both of you to suggest a game of the week for us, and then we'll go through some of the tweets that have been coming in to us at Football Ramble, at Dotton Adebayo, at Andy Brassel, and at Miguel Delaney. You can tweet us anytime during the week, and we'll try and go through the tweets and try and choose the ones worth talking about. So, talk about games of the week as well. There's a lot to choose from this week. I think it's a cracking week. Best week so far of the season, I'd have thought, in terms of the possibility of games.
I'm going Saturday tea time. I'm going to go for Borussia Mönchengladbach against Borussia Dortmund. Now, it's Marco Rosa, of course, going back to his former club, going back to Gladbach. He's so far kept his promise not to nick any of their players. I know that promise is so not far. Worth the paper it's not written on. So I would like him to go back on that promise in the near future.
The,
I think
the club can sign him, not me.
Exactly. I'm not a sporting director.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
exactly. And Dortmund have been fun so far this season. They, attacking-wise, are terrific. Obviously, we know about Erling Haaland and another brace, an incredible goal by him to seal the win.
He's not going
to
be
against
there long.
Union Berlin last weekend. No, he's not. Yeah. I think they'll have someone lined up. But Jude Bellingham really has been the star of the show so far. He's been absolutely fantastic. Defensively, they're still a dumpster fire. And you look at that game against Union last weekend as a case in point. They're 3-0 up, absolutely hammering them. And then they concede two very cheap goals, one from set piece, and it takes a bit of magic, and it was real magic from Haaland to seal the deal. So I think that is asking for trouble. I couldn't predict what this game is going to be. Gladbach just about getting there under Adi Hütter, but if you look at Lars Stindl, the captain, the striker who's not really a striker, to me his movement is far too smart for Dortmund's current defence. I think there's goals in this one.
Well, it's an evenly matched game, as you say, and that always keeps the interest up. It'll be a last-minute winner, I suspect. Miguel, what are you going to offer in match to that?
I mean, I was going to go for a Paris Saint-Germain, but in spite of myself, I now find it so compelling to see how this going to work, because it always feels like they're on the brink of like the sort of disaster that they really kind of going against everything they want. But I'm quite intrigued at the moment. I'm going to go for Real Madrid and Villarreal. It was Villarreal, I suppose, whether they can not draw a game, but I suppose the likelihood is they get beaten. But beyond that, I suppose Madrid have been quite interesting in how they've trying to kind of build themselves back up again as they kind of very much embark. It doesn't even feel like they're into a new project yet, does it? It feels like, I mean, that'll only be signaled to Mbappe signing, but it's like they're clearing everything out for a new era. But are keeping it together in spite of that with Benzema suddenly, you know, he's suddenly becoming what we felt he was going to be around 07-08, where now he's the one we're all the focus on, rather than kind of the support act to a Ronaldo or a Higuain or someone, and we're seeing what he really is.
I think the amazing thing from the job that Ancelotti has done so far is, we were talking about various dead weights before, like players who have drastically underachieved in the last couple of seasons. He got something out of Bale before he got injured. You have Marco Asensio scoring a hat trick against his hometown club, Mallorca, in the week. Even Isco scored in that. And all these players who were just completely excluded under Zidane. And that's fine. He can make his choices on who he wants in his team. But in an era when money is so tight, devaluing assets like that is not good for the club, and that's something that I think Florentino Perez will be very happy with about what Ancelotti's doing so far.
This was a Stack production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.